Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Coming up, UW announced it's shutting down its Biodiversity Institute, sending mixed messages about the university's commitment to community engagement.
Our youth education programs engage almost 1,000 K-12 students. That can be in danger.
The University of Wyoming football team had one of the nation's best defenses last year and hopes to get even better this season.
I think we can handle anything an offense can throw at us.
And we'll have a story about agricultural entrepreneurs who have gone beyond wheat, wool, and seeds to something more.
I think once you are an entrepreneur, that's just in your blood.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces. Join me and Caroline Ballard in just a few minutes. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. One of the main goals of the University of Wyoming's strategic plan is to positively impact Wyoming communities through learning outreach programs and through collaborations that make academic expertise relevant in our daily lives. UW's Biodiversity Institute is emblematic of this vision. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports, an administrative decision to close it down has raised doubts about the university's commitment to its own goals.
The sounds of hammering and heavy machinery ring throughout the northwest corner of campus, where construction workers are putting the facade on a new engineering building. But if you listen closely, you can also hear bees hard at work pollinating native plant species out on the Berry Prairie. That's the green roof of the Berry Biodiversity Conservation Center at the University of Wyoming. The space is used by the staff of the Biodiversity Institute to get kids excited about science.
And we'll get them out here to catch the bees, which is a really popular activity because there's a little bit of fear, but that always, you know, with kids and bees, but that always intrigues them a little bit more.
Gary Beauvais directs the Biodiversity Institute, or BI for short.
And to have them come out here with entomologists and show them, no, you can catch a bee safely, and you can put it in a jar, and you can look at it safely. And they start asking their own really insightful questions.
Visits like this are tailored to state K-12 science standards, and the BI engages close to 1,000 kids every year. It also runs 7 separate citizen science projects that get hundreds of volunteers gathering biological data on moose, owls, and amphibians for researchers back at UW.
We've really tried hard to get our people and our programs and our work dispersed out through the state. So we do what we call science cafes. Just last week, we had our staff up in Sheridan doing a science program with kids outside collecting aquatic insects and things like that.
Beauvais says it's all a part of an effort to make science research at UW more accessible to people around the state.
A lot of times people view science research at a university as kind of impenetrable, that they don't quite understand it, they don't know why it's done, they don't know who's doing it, or it's a little bit of a black box. And one role of the Biodiversity Institute is to open that up.
The university has been stressing outreach in recent months, so it surprised many when the administration announced abruptly that the institute will close in December, due to the university's inability to find additional private funds. The major donors were Bob and Carol Berry. They helped fund the construction of the Berry Biodiversity Conservation Center and to get the BI rolling. But additional money was never raised to keep it staffed in the long term.
And there's been some recognition for a while that the funding base needs to broaden under the BI. We've developed some partnerships and started to draw in small pieces of funding, nothing on the scale of what the Berry's provided.
Larger scale fundraising is a shared responsibility that requires action on the part of the administration and, more importantly, the UW Foundation. Many on campus are questioning whether BI fundraising was considered a priority.
I can't speak to past efforts to diversify that funding, but clearly we've not succeeded in doing it.
Ed Sinikowski is Vice President of Research and Economic Development, and he's been at UW about a year. He oversees the BI, and he recognizes the valuable contribution it's made to the university's science outreach efforts. He's working with Beauvais to find new positions for the BI staff on campus.
So those conversations are just beginning. But I'm committed to following through on them.
But the hardest task that lays before the university might be regaining trust. For instance, the Barrys, the major funder, learned of the Biodiversity Institute's closing through Wyoming Public Radio's initial reporting, and not directly from the university.
Well, I don't delight in admitting it, but I take responsibility for significant missteps in the communicating of what the administration decision is.
Sinikowski says this unfortunate event serves as an important reminder of several key things the university needs to do.
Make sure that stakeholders understand that they're valued and heard.
And he says the university administration and the foundation need to work together.
To talk about leveraging these generous gifts into greater engagement, broader engagement that is sustainable. We have to show the donors that we are committed to making their gift and their impact, the impact of their gift, last.
If donors aren't hearing that message, the risk is they might not give. I reached out to UW Foundation leadership to ask what happened, and they declined to comment. Back out on the Berry Prairie with Gary Beauvais, he points out the delicate plants that have taken root in the desert soil.
And, you know, it was a little bit of a struggle to get it established, but you can see now that it is established, it's growing very well. It's actually got some really nice native vegetation.
He hopes the university doesn't lose this and the connections the BI has formed across the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
As fires rage out west, lawmakers in Washington are rekindling a year-long debate about how to best manage the nation's forests. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Fires continue to burn in many parts of the west, and officials are bracing for a long, grueling, and even deadlier fire season than they're used to. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso chairs the Environment Committee, where he oversees the nation's forests.
We've had a lot of moisture early, which leads to significant growth. So it's always a concern. We want to make sure the funding is there. But, you know, we also have legislation for healthy forests to be able to do some of the things you need to do to lower the risk of wildfires, and we're continuing to work on that.
Barrasso says he's glad lawmakers have increased funding for fighting fires, but he says more is needed.
There continues to be discussions on the best way, you know, with last year's legislation. We now have the funding to deal with the fires, but we haven't gone as far as I would like to do with some of the conservation efforts that we can do to clear out some of the brush and the debris that makes a fire, if it starts, harder to fight and more likely to spread.
Barrasso blames environmentalists for fighting to keep forests untouched.
Always supported this idea of a healthy forest initiative as a means to prevent forest fires as well as to prevent a rapid spread. I mean, there's just so much fuel lying there that if a fire starts, a lightning strike, or some carelessness on behalf of a camper, no matter what the cause, you want to be able to get it done, get it out as quickly as you can. And the best way to do that is to have a healthier forest than as opposed to all this pent-up, build-up fuel.
In the House, Republicans have passed legislation making it easier to clear forest brush. But the bill hasn't gone anywhere in the Senate. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney sits on the Natural Resources Committee, which oversees forests in the House.
I think ultimately, and I do think the Forest Service is headed in a better direction, but ultimately we've got to get management right.
But Democrats hated the GOP passed reforms in the House. Arizona Democrat Roel Gahalva says the GOP merely wants to help private businesses, not care for forest health.
This bill is not about forest health or wildfire mitigation. It's about increasing the number of trees removed from our forests. Republicans would rather scare us into weakening environmental safeguards than work on a possible bipartisan solution to wildfire management.
California Democrat Jared Huffman agrees that the GOP efforts are misguided.
So let's call this bill what it is. It is an environmental wrecking ball that weakens standards and protections, limits public participation in the review of federal agency actions, and won't make our forests any healthier or safer.
But Cheney says these Democrats have their heads in the sand.
Yeah, no, I think there's no question. But when you start talking about the situation we're finding with respect to our forests, you know, it is really hard for anybody to argue against the conditions that we find right now. And the conditions are clearly a result of bad federal management, devastating federal management.
Cheney says the federal government has hurt the nation's forests, and it's time for federal officials to get out of the way and allow locals to take care of their own forests.
And, you know, situations where we've had such massive beetle kill, then you have a blowdown, then you can't get in to clear out the blowdown because of the roadless rule. And so the federal policies have clearly contributed to really a devastation of a hugely important natural resource.
It's an election year, so the schedule is tight. But Western lawmakers are renewing calls to overhaul the nation's forest rules, and they want action sooner than later. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we return, we'll hear about a documentary and book that explore what happened to the barracks at the Heart Mountain Detention Camp for the Japanese Americans after World War II. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard. When you go to your local library, you might expect to pick up the latest beach read or get some internet time on a computer. But how about a dose of naloxone, the opioid reversal drug? The Mountain West News Bureau's Eric Newman reports.
At the West Jordan Library outside Salt Lake City, Peter Sadler is stabbing an orange with a syringe.
So try to be as calm and collected as you can, and then gently just place the needle in the orange and then inject the fluid.
Sadler works with Utah Naloxone, a nonprofit that teaches people how to use the fast-acting overdose reversal drug. He's here with librarians from around Salt Lake County.
Pretty easy to do. Do you want to try that?
Sure.
Okay.
Trainings like this are pretty common. The nonprofit holds them at universities, addiction recovery centers, and hospitals. But today is a recent development. That's because Salt Lake County is likely the first library system in the country to stock and give out naloxone kits.
Libraries are strategically placed around the county. It's a very comfortable environment for people to seek access for this.
It's obviously a new role for librarians. Crystal Ward is at the training. She's the manager at the nearby Riverton Library.
We have tax forms, we have ebooks, we have books and audio things. We have great things to entertain our kids and programs, but this is kind of something that can help someone save their lives.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, around 115 people die from an opioid overdose every day in the U.S. Naloxone, also known as Narcan, has been around since the 70s. It used to be a prescription-only drug, but as the nation grapples with the devastating opioid epidemic, many states have adopted laws to make it more accessible. And it's not only the public health community that's endorsing it.
It's literally just a miracle drug.
That's Brian Besser with the Drug Enforcement Administration in Utah.
From a public safety perspective, especially from a DEA perspective, we want to see Narcan and Naloxone get into the hands of as many people as possible, whether it's private homes, educational institutions, faith-based institutions. We want to see that because if it saves lives, it saves lives. It's just that simple.
There's no doubt that naloxone saves lives. But could increasing access to the drug create a false safety net? That's what Anita Mukherjee worries about. She's an economist at the University of Wisconsin.
There's no area in the U.S. where we see a statistically significant reduction in mortality because of naloxone access.
Mukherjee recently co-authored a paper on what she calls the unintended consequences of increased access to naloxone. Her state-by-state analysis showed no reduction in overdose deaths. In fact, in the Midwest, there was a slight increase. So why does she think that is?
People might take more risks because you've basically now reduced the risk of death from overdose.
Mukherjee emphasizes that naloxone is an important life-saving drug, but she cautions that the overall effects on death rates are negligible if people don't get treatment for their addiction. Her research has gotten a lot of pushback from the public health community. Jennifer Plum is a pediatrician and the co-founder of Utah Naloxone. She disagrees with Mukherjee's conclusions and with the quality of the study.
You better have a pretty rigorous methodology and pretty good measures put into place if you're going to start to make judgments like, boy, this is either a net zero or possibly even making it worse.
For example, Plum criticized the researchers' use of Google search data to assess increased interest and awareness of naloxone. Plum adds naloxone access programs are preventing overdose deaths, sometimes the same drug user multiple times. And she says with a disease as complex as opioid addiction, that's important if they're ever going to get into recovery.
Nothing's perfect in this realm, right? And of course, the naloxone's not perfect either, except it is, if you can get it to somebody in time, it's perfect at making sure somebody's not dead.
Utah Naloxone and Intermountain Healthcare donated the 400 kits, which are now at 18 libraries in Salt Lake County. According to staff, so far around 50 kits have been picked up. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Eric Newman.
A documentary and book explore what happened to the barracks at Heart Mountain Detention Camp for Japanese Americans after World War II. The film was released in December 2017, Moving Walls, The Barracks of America's Concentration Camps, and tells the little-known story of how hundreds of barracks were sold to veterans to homestead in northwest Wyoming. Sharon Yamato, the filmmaker, wanted to explore the connection between these two different communities in an effort to create a dialogue. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska asked Yamato what was the significance of the barracks to the homesteaders.
They were absolutely critical to their being able to settle here because given the weather, given a lot of the conditions here, so had they not had these buildings, I think it would have been almost impossible for them to settle here. So the fact that these settlers lived in the identical buildings and how they dealt with the problems was also another thing that sort of pulled me to the subject.
And how did this draw a connection to the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated?
So my goal always was to get back to educating people about the original camp and what it was like. So I always brought that subject up in interviews with locals who really in some ways had not either talked about it or thought about it a lot. I was hoping to get a sense of what they felt about this experience and how they personally related to it. And the results were rather surprising because I think in a lot of ways there had been very little change in attitudes among these homesteaders who'd lived here for a long period of time in the way that they thought about the camp. I got many people who felt that it was built for the protection of Japanese Americans. That was shocking to me, you know, very, very shocking. But I thought it important to point that out in the documentary because I think it's an attitude that prevails. And, you know, it's an attitude that in a place like this could easily, it's easily understandable why it is, because it's rather isolated. It's in a, you know, in a desolate area. And these people were hardworking farmers. But I also wanted to hear their stories, how they managed, what happened, how they were able to survive in these buildings. And I thought they were really pretty honest about how difficult it was, but also the fact that it was a survival salvation for them. They were like the pioneers. They were like original American pioneers. It was something that they asked for, and they were happy that they got. Certainly, there were a slew of complaints about how difficult it was, but it's an answer to the American dream.
Did you kind of see an irony there?
Absolutely. I call it the American nightmare that became the American dream. I tried to show it by interviewing incarcerees who were here living in those buildings, talking a little bit about how difficult their life was, and contrast it with the homesteaders who live in them. Some of them still live in them, and talk about how difficult it was, but how it also became homes for them. That was an important contrast, I thought, an important comparison and contrast, and very interesting to see the attitudes among Japanese Americans and among the homesteaders, because there was very little interaction between them.
And what stands out the most to you?
I think what's been most gratifying to me is learning about the people of Wyoming and learning what motivated the racism, the attitudes toward having this Japanese American camp right in their midst. My goal has always been to draw the connection between the local population and the camps, because I think it's really important for us to learn about each other. And I came to Wyoming the first time and I felt very much a stranger, but now I feel a little more like I understand just a little more about what the people here are like and how they feel. And I think that's really important for us as a nation to draw connections with people. So I feel very grateful that I was able to connect with some of these people, even though their attitudes were really, really, in some ways, very frightening to me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the fact that they've still felt that the camp was built for the protection of the Japanese Americans is a frightening concept, because it clearly was not. They were forced there against their will, and the fact that we were, you know, imprisoned there basically with barbed wire and security and guns and all of that. I think it's important to realize the gravity of it, and I'm hoping that because the story is still not as well known as I'd like it to be, I think it's important for the local population to hopefully have some awareness of just how unjust it was.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaking with filmmaker Sharon Yamato, discussing the connection between two very different communities that lived in the Heart Mountain Barracks. Coming up, we'll hear from candidate Charlie Hardy and about entrepreneurs in Southeast Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Longtime political candidate Charlie Hardy is taking another run at public office. Hardy, whose run is an independent and a Democrat, is now running against Senator John Barrasso as a Republican. Hardy is someone who says he doesn't believe in political parties, but he always considered himself an Eisenhower Republican. And that's why he says he's suited for this race. He joins me now. Well, what's your message to some of the Republicans in the state? Obviously, you're probably not going to reach some of the far right-leaning people, but those moderates that are out there that I think there are people out there that believe they're disenfranchised. What's your message to them? Why should they vote for you?
I would repeat something that President Eisenhower once said. He said, and these are as close to his words as I can remember them, in everything that deals with people, we must be liberal human, and everything which deals with people's money, their economy, their form of government, we must be conservative. And so I know that word liberal is kind of a dirty word among many people, but what he was saying was, we have to put people first, okay? I mean, but we also have to be conservative with the way we deal with their money, and we shouldn't be wasting that. So I like to think I'm a liberal conservative or a conservative liberal. I like to think I'm walking in the footsteps of President Eisenhower, and many young people wouldn't even remember who he was, but he was.
Well, let's talk about one issue that's on everybody's mind right now, and that's immigration. We've got, it depends on where you stand, whether the president has a tougher policy than the Obama administration, but there's obviously a problem if we continue to have to talk about this issue. How do we finally resolve it?
And I'll say this. Okay, now it's kind of come to a head, but there were big problems in the Obama administration, too. I've been at protests down in Lumpkin, Georgia, at a detention center. Eloy, Arizona, the same way. What we have to keep in mind is, most important of all, is we're talking about human beings. Carl Sandburg once said, there is only one man in the world, and that man is every man. There's only one woman in the world, and that woman is every woman. There's only one child in the world, and that is all children. we're dealing with human beings. And when we think about, in general, most people in Wyoming probably identify themselves as Christians. And in the Bible, Matthew 25, there it is. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. And as long as you did it to any of these, the least of my brothers, you did it to me. No, we're talking about human beings, and that has to be the basis for any policy.
But people might push back and say, sure, but we don't need bad human beings here. We don't need people that are maybe parts of gangs or are looking to do people in the United States some harm. So how do we sift them out of the mix?
That's true, and I don't want to defend those people. But the people that I have met with, I've been on both sides of the border in the United States, Mexico. I was in a garbage dump one day, and people were going through the garbage. And I said, why don't you work in one of the U.S. factories around here? And they said, in spite of the putrid situations here, we can make more money here than we can in one of those factories. I've been with people, they're fleeing situations. Going back to the 56 and the Republican platform, where they talked about we must, refugees, they talk about how we must admit refugees. At that time, they were talking about the Soviet Union and fleeing from communism and so on. But these people leaving Honduras, leaving El Salvador, and we also have to recognize that we have to assume responsibility for much of that. People were not leaving Honduras until we helped overthrow the government in Honduras. But most of all, oh, Lord, I've had contact with so many immigrants, good, beautiful people, and they're living in fear. They're living in fear. Kids in school, I substitute teach junior high and high school kids, and I know many of those kids worry, will their mother or father be home when they get home that day?
Charlie Hardy visiting with us. He's a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. The person that currently holds the U.S. Senate seat, John Barrasso, not a real big fan of the Affordable Care Act, to say the least. And I'm curious your thoughts on how we get to where maybe we want to go with health care. What's your vision? What do we need to provide? And then how do we get there?
I believe our nation will be stronger if everybody is healthy. And so I'd be in favor of universal health care, universal Medicare for everyone. And people then come back and say, well, how are you going to pay for that? Something that isn't addressed is our whole foreign policy. President Eisenhower, again, warned against the military-industrial complex. Okay, down in Fort Benning, Georgia, for example, Columbus, you see stores where they sell better equipment to our servicemen and women than what they're being issued. It's our military budget. It's bigger than the next eight countries together, including Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, and so on. We have special operations in 149 countries around the world. I think we presently have ambassadors in only 147. That whole military budget, nobody's talking about it. But that's a place that there is need for real cuts. We have four times more generals now than we had on D-Day at the end of the Second World War. It's top heavy. And then they get out and they go into the military-industrial complex. So we're talking about health care. How do we fund it? We could fund it if we stopped blowing up we stopped blowing up roads in countries around the world and started addressing the problems within our own country. And one of those is health care. We'll be stronger if everyone is healthy.
And so your idea would be to blow up the Affordable Care Act and then try and develop a universal health care program?
Yes. The problem I have with the Affordable Care Act is that word affordable. I don't think health care should be a commodity. It should be something. Take care of everybody and we will be a healthier nation. And I'm going to say the same thing about education. College education or training for a career, we will be stronger. We're importing people from all over the world who got their education in other countries and didn't have to pay what our people here have to pay for. It's just as high school, junior high school, that's considered to be a right. We will be a stronger nation if everybody is able to be educated as well as possible.
You talk about cutting defense spending, but When I look at us breaking maybe away from NATO, and I look at us not having many friends in the room right now, maybe we shouldn't be cutting defense spending. I'm curious about that, because it sounds like we may have put ourselves in a position where we better have some of that money.
Yes, and we don't need to be the police people around the world. Okay, again, I teach high school kids. I sometimes ask them, how many of you know someone who is in the military, who has been in the military? Everyone raise their hands. How many of you know someone who's been in the Peace Corps, who is in the Peace Corps? And inevitably, a student says to me, what is that? It was a dream, but no, we need to make friends around the world. You know, I lived in a barrio in South America in a cardboard shack for 8 years. One day, the police raided my house. And no one could see what was going on. That night, a kid said to me, Charlie, I'm ashamed of what happened to you. You're a foreigner, but I'm glad for two reasons. One, now you know how the police treat us all the time. And the other thing is, usually when the police come in the barrio, everyone hides. But today, all your neighbors came out. And while the police were in there, they were gathering rocks and bottles. And if the police would have come out of your shack with you, they were going to start pelting the police. Now, that to me is good foreign policy. I feel sorry for our young men and women who have to run around or, you know, go around with bulletproof vests, goggles, all this kind of stuff, and nobody's ready to defend them. We should be making friends around the world instead of enemies. My dad always said, if the politicians want to go to war, they should be the first ones to go.
Charlie, how can people find out more about you?
Well, on Facebook, most places, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and so on, it's Run With Charlie. I think Instagram, it's Run With Charlie 2018. And we kind of have a website too, runwithcharlie.com. This is all being done with volunteers. We have no paid staff. We have young people who are enthusiastic, and they're the ones who are running all this social media. And we're excited. We're excited about this.
Charlie Hardy, always a pleasure. He is a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. Thank you.
And thank you, Bob. It's a privilege to be on Wyoming Public Radio and having a chance to talk with the people of Wyoming.
When you hear the word entrepreneur, you might think of someone in their garage building Facebook, Apple, or some new world-changing app. But right here, in a tiny corner of southeast Wyoming, in a 26-mile radius, three women are taking entrepreneurship back to its roots, using local sensibilities and old-fashioned techniques to sell products. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim has the story.
Carl Sagan once said,
"If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe."
South of Wheatland on the Baker farm, Terry and Dennis Baker take Sagan's idea as far as it can go. They have a wheat farm, and have for 40 years. But these days, they don't just sell that wheat. They harvest it, store it, mill it, sift it, and finally, bake it. Maybe they can't invent the universe, but Terry's small baking business is truly made from scratch.
This is German rye bread, if anybody likes that. Pumpkin bread, cranberry walnut, apricot walnut cray pie, coconut cray pie, and then I'll cut some mint.
In her small commercial kitchen, Terry Baker is surrounded by desserts and breads she's made with her own wheat, tagged with Made in Wyoming stickers. This isn't the Baker's first foray into entrepreneurship. A while ago, they were part owners of Chugwater Chili.
I think once you are an entrepreneur, that's just in your blood, and you want to keep doing things like that.
Before that, the Bakers found other ways to add value to their wheat. They went certified organic, sold unique species of wheat to distilleries. In fact, just recently, they sold 38 bushels to Backwoods Distilling Company in Casper.
It's called Marquee Wheat, and it's a cross between Red Calcutta and Red Fife that has such a different flavor than the modern wheat, so.
Bourbon, whiskey, breads, desserts, even cereals, the Bakers found a way to go beyond just selling their wheat and appeal to that local farm-to-table sensibility. On a small property not far from the Baker farm, another woman is experimenting in barn to yarn. That's Carol's passion.
I'm Carol Eckhart.
Carol sits at her spinning wheel with a large paper bag next to her. It's full of loose, knotted white wool.
This is raw wool, and Claire, the sheep from whom this came, was a cross between a Shetland and a Tunis, and she was a really sweet animal, too.
Surrounding her are hats, shawls, jackets. She's made all of them. and not from yarn in a store. Eckhart does everything that goes into these products. For years, she raised flocks of sheep and sheared them. Now, she cleans it, spins the yarn, and even knits to make products like these. Like the bakers, she found a way to take a resource from step one to a finished product.
So much of what we consume originates in one country and is processed in another country. It's really hard to have a personal connection with something that you wear or eat or use when that's true.
About 30 minutes north of Eckhart's is the Marker property near Wheatland. It's overcast as Shelley walks out of her house. There are several gardens, a small, partially underground greenhouse, and buildings where her husband Derek does contracting work. The birds are pretty loud here.
They chatter pretty hard.
Shelley Marker, with transition glasses and a quick smile, loves to garden. Peppers, tomatoes, pumpkins, corn, everything. And she found the perfect niche in her community that she was ready to fill.
Last year I just had the thought, there's not a nursery or greenhouse for bedding plants anymore.
Bedding plant, that's just any potted plant, really.
It's all in town, which is fine, but I just thought that people might be interested in the locally grown, you know, and I thought I'd give it a try, and they were.
Shelley started with peppers and tomatoes, put them in little pots, and people visited her property to buy them. And later, she even took them to the local supply store, which she said sold out, thanks to the locally grown sign.
I was amazed at the response that I got. People really want locally grown and organic and homegrown bedding plants.
It led her to start her business, Holy Sprouts. The operation is still small right now, but she likes the idea of scaling it up.
I had people asking for squash plants, zucchini plants, cucumber plants.
As Marker looks to expanding, it's clear something is working. She's appealing to that same local sensibility that drives Baker Bread and Eckhart Wool. Whether it's farm to table, barn to yarn, or ground to garden, that sells. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
The primary election takes place on August 21st, and candidates are hitting the home stretch of campaigning. If you're a Republican, you're probably aware of the election due to the countless mailers you've been getting. My co-host Bob Beck has been following the campaign for governor and has participated in a handful of debates and joins us now. Bob, the Republican Party has shifted right nationally, and I'm curious if you've seen that reflected in this campaign.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody's trying to tie themselves in with President Trump. You've got a lot of people taking maybe some conservative positions that they may or may not have taken in the past. And, you know, just one great example of this, the other night, Taylor Haynes was talking about he would like all the wolves shot like we do coyotes in the state, and the audience applauded and everybody on the stage applauded. So if there's a position you can take that's a little to the right, that's the position all the candidates are taking right now, because I think polling shows that that's the place to be.
What are some of the key issues we're seeing at play?
Well, the first thing I should just tell you, that you don't have any candidate that has said, oh, wow, we want to raise taxes. I even asked a question about fairness issues the other night in a debate. So you have people in the energy industry that think they're paying too many taxes. They think they're footing the bill for the state of Wyoming, and think a lot of industries that get sales tax exemptions or some of these people that aren't paying the level of taxes that they are should participate. If you think about it, that would probably even out the revenue base in the state. And that's something that we've seen in a couple of studies. Well, nobody wants to do that either, because that would raise taxes for other people. So if you're worried about them coming in, dealing with our revenue shortfall by raising taxes, you can be assured that nobody is at least admitting that's something they want to do right now. So that's been one issue. Cutting government, they all want to do it. They want to do it different ways. That was a really interesting answer that we've heard. You know, a lot of people, Harriet Hageman, Taylor Haynes, want to get rid of Endow, aren't real big fans of the Wyoming Business Council. Bill Dahlin has said that as well. And then you also have Sam Galeotos and Mark Gordon, who are big fans of economic development and that sort of thing. They don't want to cut that. But what they want to do is be more efficient. So they're looking at efficiencies. They're looking at the efficiency study that was done by the legislature, which could save several hundred million dollars. Galeotos, time and time again, big fan of that. Gordon wants to consolidate agencies, thinks government's just simply too big. Hageman has said the same kind of thing. So Foster Freeze thinks we're spending too much money on things that don't matter and are just nice. So he would like to see some cuts there. And so, yeah, cutting government has been a theme. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention, you know, no surprise that nobody wants to expand Medicaid or this bunch. That's probably not something that you want to say in a debate. But and they don't like Obamacare. But what they do like, and one thing they're all very concerned about, is mental health funding in the state of Wyoming and the lack of availability of mental health services. Harriet Hageman, very passionate about this topic, and others have joined in this. They all realize that this is a huge problem in the state of Wyoming. What's interesting about that is that goes opposite of what we've seen from our Appropriations Committee in the legislature and of the Republican Party who have been in the legislature. I'm not saying all of them, but they've cut funding for these things. And what we're seeing from this bunch is that that's not something we want to continue doing. In fact, we can maybe resolve prison overcrowding. We can address our suicide rate if we would just do a better job with mental health services. So that's been very interesting to hear them talk about.
Who are the front runners here, and what are their differences?
Well, I really think here, if you look at it, Taylor Haynes is going to get some votes. There's no doubt about it, whether or not he gets removed from the ballot or not, because he's got a lot of supporters. He always has, and there's X amount of votes that will always go to Taylor Haynes. And he's had a good campaign. I think he's debated very well. He has some different views on things than other people, but I think he's done a good job. Harriet Hageman has run an outstanding campaign, and she has some different ideas. She's, if you're looking for an outsider, if you're looking for someone that's got a little different views than you would typically hear traditionally, she's probably the one. She's really trying to get government out of people's way. Really, boy, she wants transparency, and boy, does she want to get rid of regulations. That's one of the things that she's very big on. There are some downsides to that too, and I think some of the other candidates have tried to point that out. But Harriet, you know, we're representing a part of the state that tends to be very conservative. Those values have certainly come out. And so I think that's going to get her some support. She's the one of the group that's gone a little more negative. And so we'll see how that plays with voters. Mark Gordon, he's the one that's been in public office in the past few years. He certainly knows state government very well. That's come out. Not sure he's debated as great as some people would have liked, but, you know, you can get a confidence. He does know the system and has, you know, he's been very well versed on a lot of the issues that we've heard him talk about. Sam Galeotos has done a very good job. You can also sense that he, you know, he has a technology background. He has he knows about economic development. He's been a small business person as well, and that's coming out. So I think Gordon and Galeotos, and as well as Harriet Hageman, seem to be the big three right now, and they've all been impressive in their own right. And as you're a voter, I think you just need to say, how do they line up with my values? Who's going to do the best job? And you make that choice. But it's really been interesting to watch them go. And I think where Gordon and Galeotos are is, how do I get a little more separation from the other person? Because they do tend to sound alike, where Harriet Hageman is certainly different.
How is this campaign different from past campaigns?
Social media, no question. Some of them have really leaped on that. They've gotten some interesting videos out. They have the traditional media that we all know about, but they've gone beyond that, and they've been able to reach out to voters and in some other ways. But, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes it's legwork. You know, Harriet Hageman got after this campaign way earlier than the rest of them. And so she's made some contacts. And I think people are understanding her viewpoint. I think Gordon, you know, he was a little hampered because he was in office, had to get through the legislative session and that kind of thing. And so he's, you know, he's maybe a little behind as far as getting out and campaigning. Same with Sam Galeotos. But I think that what's different is the social media aspect. The debates have been very good, very entertaining, and a lot of interesting discussion.
How do you see enthusiasm among voters for this election?
It's very high. It's higher than I would have expected for the summer. And I noticed that in the two debates, well, I've been involved in three, and the debates that I've been at have been very well attended. A lot of interest in this, and a lot of, you can see social media discussions on Facebook and Twitter and all that about the candidates. And I think it's gotten a lot of attention. I think that there are people that are still at that point where they do not know who they're going to vote for. And I think that might actually carry up to when you walk in and have to cast your vote, because we did an early poll, 35% undecided in June. Not a huge surprise, but that's still a very high number. And so if and you're looking for those independents who swing right, vote in the Republican primary. If a lot of people, they vote in the Republican primary because that's the only way they can cast a vote, maybe for a local race. And so you're trying to grab those people who are over there anyway to come in and vote for you. And so it's reaching those people. And that's going to be a very important thing for them in the next couple of weeks.
Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ahead, we'll wrap up the program with a look at the UW football team's defense this season. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. 2 years ago, Wyoming's defense struggled. Last season, it was one of the best in the nation. The Cowboys ranked number one in the nation in takeaways, ninth in scoring defense, and 23rd overall. This season, many publications say Wyoming will have one of the 10 best defenses in the country. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
It's the first week of practice, and the Cowboys' defense is already making plays. But that's not a surprise. The Pokes are picked to go to another bowl game this year, mainly on the strength of their defense. Their defensive line could arguably be one of the best in school history, and senior strong safety Andrew Wingard could set the school record for tackles. Head coach Craig Bohl doesn't like harping on individuals, but he admits these guys are pretty good.
Andrew's an instinctive player. He's playing fast. He's a great tackler. Carl Granderson, you know, he's put on probably close to 90 pounds, and he's really athletic. And Johanna Gaffan and Logan Wilson, and I think Tyler Hall, these guys are all guys who play for a lot of different people, and I think a lot of them are going to be playing on Sundays.
Which means he thinks they will play in the NFL. The architect of the defense is Scotty Hazleton. He's a veteran assistant coach who recently was an assistant with the NFL's Jacksonville Jaguars, but he jumped at the chance to come to Wyoming and lead the defense. Hazleton says he simply got them pointed in the right direction.
We had really good players. We had guys that that liked playing ball and weren't scared of working really hard to things. So really it's more of a credit to them than anything that we did as staff.
But safety Andrew Wingard says it was more than that. He says Hazleton simplified things.
It wasn't guys being having to do this, that, this, and that, and be thinking on the field. We were all out there just reacting. That's what you got to do on defense. If you think for 1 second, you're wrong.
Hazleton says Wingard is one of a strong group of team leaders that have taken ownership of the defense. He says they have a swagger, and that's translated to the rest of the unit.
It's fun to watch them because they hold each other accountable, and they strain to work really hard, and then they talk trash to each other when they're not doing right, you know. So it's really fun to see them, and they took great ownership in it.
Defensive end Carl Granderson, who at 6'5", 261 pounds, is one of the top pass rushers in the nation. He says not only are they bringing back some great players, but the younger players are getting better and better, which will keep the unit from tiring. Granderson says the squad is good, but it can get better.
But we got room for improvement on takeaways and just stopping the run.
Remember, Wyoming led the nation in takeaways last year. Granderson also has some personal goals.
Sack numbers, you know, I want at least 17, so that's probably 1.5 sacks a game. That's the goal. But I'll do whatever it takes to for the team, man.
By the way, that's a lot of sacks and would have easily led the nation last season. One of his fellow first-team All-Conference defensive linemen, Johanna Gaffon, cannot wait for the season to start.
I think we can handle anything an offense can throw at us. I think we'll do so much better than last year's defense, which is crazy to say because we really killed it last year, but I think we're going to be even more dangerous than we've ever been.
That might sound cocky, but Gaffon disagrees.
We walk around with our chest up as a whole defensive group, and we just think that nobody can really stop us. But that's not really cockiness. That's confidence right there.
Safety Andrew Wingard says the defense remembered the teams that ran up the score on them 2 years ago, and so the unit played with a chip on its shoulder most of last season. He says if they continue to play that way, he also believes the sky's the limit for the Wyoming defense this season. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire program or individual segments, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.